Hey, I'm Saji Wickramasekara, and this is Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. Today, I'm speaking with Karen Akinsanya. Her career bridges two eras of science, the hands-on rigor of traditional R&D and the algorithm-driven precision of modern computation. At Ferring, she led the discovery and development of a new treatment for prostate cancer. At Merck, she shaped strategy across the entire R&D lifecycle with roles in discovery, clinical pharmacology, and business development. Today, she's president of R&D at Schrödinger, leading a new era of drug discovery powered by physics-based modeling and machine learning. Karen, thank you so much for being here tonight. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Karen Akinsanya, I practiced that three times, has spent the last 30 years at the intersection of science, technology, and biopharma. She's currently the president of R&D for therapeutics at Schrödinger. She's responsible for the discovery and development of therapeutics, as well as business development and collaboration, so pretty much everything. Karen started her career at Ferring Pharmaceuticals, where she led on the discovery and development of a new treatment for prostate cancer. Much of her career was at Merck, where she wore many hats in clinical pharmacology, discovery, preclinical and early development, before moving into business development. One thing I'm really impressed by is that Karen's career shows this remarkable range and curiosity for every facet of the R&D process and business throughout her career. So I'm very excited to dive into the work you're doing today, blending tech and science. So thanks for being here, Karen. Looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Let's start with career path. So your move to Schrödinger, a computationally driven company, feels like a convergence of timing, of tech evolution, and your own journey through so many facets of the biopharma industry. Can you talk us through this convergence, and what was the tipping point where you knew computational science was the next big disruption for medicine?
Yeah, so I think I'll go back a little bit before the time where I decided to leave Merck and join Schrödinger. Back to about 25 years ago, a week ago, when I was still in the UK, and I was at Ferring Pharmaceuticals, as you pointed out, and we were trying to pick targets. And we used to do this talking to academics, right? We'd go around and interview them and say, what are you working on? And it became pretty clear to me, I picked up Nature and I read this paper that was about a rare genetic disorder where they'd figured out what the mutation was that was causing this disorder. And it occurred to me that if you could do that at scale, like figure out, and this was when the Human Genome Project and everything was going on, that we'd be able to do a much better job at picking targets. And so I tell that story because I think my whole career, it's been about how do we do a better job of what we're trying to solve for, which is making medicines for patients. And so the story about joining Schrödinger was very similar. I had spent well over a decade at Merck trying to discover and develop medicines. I actually spent time in clinical pharmacology, where you are one of those people that gets to dose a patient with a drug for the very first time. It's absolutely exhilarating.
Scary, very scary.
But quite often, of course, we were killing molecules within weeks, if not months, of having done a lot of work to get it into the patient. And I became very, very focused on the idea that if we could only test more ideas, test more hypotheses, and be much more efficient about coming up with the molecule and having a better chance of having a molecule that survives that initial test, wouldn't that be great? So,
did you have any computational inkling? Did you dabble before? Not a bit.
Not really, except I love Excel, right?
Okay.
I've always loved Excel.
Put some cheers in the back.
So we actually at Merck decided that we were going to survey the landscape to see if there was a different way of doing what we were doing. And I got put in charge of this Lab of the Future project.
There's still Lab of the Future projects going on at every pharma company.
And we surveyed the landscape and we came across Schrödinger. One morning we woke up and another pharma had published the molecules that we were working on. They had the same patent. They had a patent with almost all the same molecules. And we were like, oh my gosh, we've invested millions here. How are we going to recover from this? And we enlisted Schrödinger, who apparently had a platform that could identify molecules very quickly and solve for very complex target product profiles. And everyone didn't believe it. They said, you know, oh yeah, there's a lot of companies out there saying they can do all sorts of things. And this pilot was hugely successful. Not only did they find very unique molecules, but they found multiple series of them within a couple of months. And so it sort of occurred to me that something's happening here, right? Computation, this approach to computation, which is physics-based methods, just accelerated our ability to solve for a problem we had that day. But wow, what if we could do that more systematically? And that's the story of how I ended up leaving Merck and joining Schrödinger.
So the results were so compelling that you were like, I have to go.
I have to go. I have to be able to attempt to build a pipeline and ask more questions, test more hypotheses.
Was Merck mad at Schrödinger when they already?
No.
So computational platforms are clearly redefining timelines. In the case of 1505, SGR-1505, yep. A target for the treatment of non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphomas, it took 10 months, just 10 months, to discover a development candidate, which is one of the fastest timelines for Schrödinger gate and just fast for the industry as a whole.
Yep.
To give more color, Schrödinger's ML-powered platform sorted through 8.2 billion potential compounds over 10 months, identified 78 that were synthesized and filtered through preclinical experiments to select the most promising candidate. I mean, first, congrats on the progress and impact, but how did you achieve this, and what does it signal for the future of drug discovery?
Yeah, so maybe I'll just dig into that story a little bit further. We synthesized 78 molecules. Most drug discovery programs, I think you're aware, or historically at least, because look, everyone in this room, I think, is moving those numbers and metrics in a very interesting direction. But before the 78, which is everything we did to come up with our clinical candidate, which is now in phase one, it was actually the 10th molecule that we made that had good enough properties to actually go in vivo and validate the pharmacology. So the 8.2 billion, and I want to be very clear about this because I think there's a little bit of high expectation about what computational methods, whether it's AI, ML, physics-based methods combined with ML. Drug discovery is hard for a reason, right? You're not just trying to solve for potency. You're trying to solve for selectivity. You're trying to solve for solubility or brain penetration. And the 8.2 billion compounds was really our attempt to find a molecule that didn't just solve one of those things. As you can imagine, when you sort through 8.2 billion, instead of what one would have typically done, say when I joined Merck, you'd screen 2 million compounds. The chances you're going to find an individual molecule that has the target product profile all in that molecule are very low. Or you have to keep doing successive screens and successive chemistry to find that molecule. And so the 8.2 billion allowed us to find very rapidly molecules that had in vivo pharmacology results that essentially compelled us to solve not just for the potency and selectivity issue, but to solve for a drug that has, we believe, really excellent properties in man. And so 78 compounds got us essentially to the development candidate and also an in vivo package. So let's be clear. When you read articles that talk about AI and finding the molecule, of course, that's not the end of it. You have to get it into tox studies and pharmacology studies and do human dose prediction. And
eventually get it approved.
And get it approved, ultimately. Within that 78 molecules was SGR-1505 that had fantastic properties, great human dose predictions, and that was an amazing journey. But I want to be clear, it's only one of about 50 journeys we've been on. Schrödinger is a 35-year-old company, and I think 35 years ago, compute wasn't fast enough, right? The math wasn't working, so many things weren't working. But over that 30-year journey, we've taken many, many approaches to come up with development candidates. Not 8.2 billion, that's pretty standard today, but that wasn't standard a while ago.
Totally. Let's dig into that 35-year journey. Was Schrödinger just a software company when you joined?
Yes.
Okay, so today Schrödinger is a very unique business model. There's dual licensing of the software, but Schrödinger also has its own drug pipeline, has had some, you know, phenomenal successes. Can you tell us about like that, first that evolution, yeah, you know, going from a software company selling the Schrödinger technology to biotech and pharma companies to having a drug development roadmap, and how the two shape each other and what the interplay is like between them? Should we put software developer on your CV?
Well, no, I'm definitely not a software developer. However, I would say that the hallmark, I think, of Schrödinger is that when the method started to work, I think someone mentioned, one of your prior panelists, that cover of Time magazine, where there were very, very profound claims being made about computation and how it was going to change drug discovery. Unfortunately, it was a very disappointing period where computation wasn't working and it wasn't replacing what medicinal chemists were doing.
Was this a cover from like the 90s or something?
Yeah, within the 90s, yeah. Exactly.
So there have been a couple of moments where sort of biotech has kind of proclaimed, hey, computation is going to solve medicine.
Yes, interestingly, I think we're in one of those moments now where AI
is different, right?
So there was a lot of disappointment in pharma that really these methods weren't working very well. So Schrödinger decided to do something pretty interesting. As the methods really began to work, and they'd go back to pharma and say, believe us, it really works this time, you know, just amazing results. They were like, yeah, right, okay.
Heard this before.
Yeah. So essentially, Schrödinger decided to co-found a company called Nimbus, where the idea was use the platform and only the platform to come up with drugs and then try and sell them to pharma. And that's a long story that started, I think, 13, 14 years ago. The first molecule that they were able to identify was an ACC inhibitor. That was one of the largest transactions at the time with Gilead. So even we at Merck actually were working on this target called ACC. No one could get a selective molecule. The Nimbus molecule was the first example of a selective compound.
Do you remember about how big that transaction was with Gilead?
$600 million upfront.
Okay.
And that was years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there was a much more impressive one in the last
couple years. Recently, yeah. The second program that they partnered with Takeda was $4.something billion. So these billion-dollar molecules, what did we take away from that? So back to your question. You cannot develop technology in a vacuum. You need to pressure test these molecules against problems that pharma cares about. And I think that's the lesson of the Nimbus story, which has now been followed by Morphic and Petra and all of these companies that essentially, between having our own pipeline and selling software, we've co-founded quite a lot of companies who exclusively use our platform to come up with drugs. And those transactions, I think, are a litmus test to the fact that not only does the technology work, the molecules are winning molecules, right?
What you mentioned, there was a point at which the methods really started to work.
Yes.
Like what made it tip? Like why did they sort of not work to the degree you wanted one day and then the next it just clicked?
Yeah. Compute got fast enough, the physics started working, the math started working, free energy perturbation calculations became almost routine, scalable. Today we're combining free energy calculations with machine learning to actually generate data sets for individual targets. And so it was really this convergence that you described earlier, mm-hmm, of technology, fundamental science. I mean, the fundamental physics behind all of this,
yeah,
atomistic modeling, structural biology, we're sort of at this interesting time now, actually, with structural biology also making huge strides.
What do you think gave the organization just conviction to keep going? Because it was probably a 20-year journey before things started to really work. I'm sure there was lots of success along the way, but it's like that's a long time. And I think biotech is riddled with, like, there's lots of failure in medicines. I think for all the entrepreneurs out there, understanding like how these organizations can persevere is really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two stories here, one of which is an investment story, which I think we have to explain, that the two people who actually came from completely other domains, but not unrelated, David Shaw, the father of quantitative trading, and Bill Gates, I think we all know who he is, heard about Schrodinger and had some conviction that this physical chemist, Rich Friesner, who was the founder of Schrodinger, was right, that if you could get the math and the physics right and combine it with computation, it was going to be transformational.
So it took actually outsiders helping.
Yeah, patient capital, right? That's the point I'm making here, is that if it weren't for those two patient investors waiting for the physics, the math, and all of that to work and the computation to get fast enough, I'm not sure Schrodinger would actually be here.
Wow.
Because, you know, VCs have a shorter...
Shorter time horizon.
Yeah.
At a recent event, you posed this kind of thought-provoking idea, how technology and data generation outside of biology, so for example, the creator economy flooding the world with cat videos, you know, how that can advance image and pattern recognition that helps lead to breakthroughs in biology.
Yeah.
Can you connect the dots for us? You know, is there a greater purpose to all the memes?
Well, I would say that advances are built on other advances, in the sense that now image recognition, we wouldn't have, I think, the quality of machine learning models and image recognition if it were not for internet videos, internet cats, internet images. And yet here we are as biologists, chemists, physicists, etc., leveraging that advance that was really driven by the creator economy and people uploading thousands of images of cats. I would say the same thing about ChatGPT in a way. Of course, language and video are very different to chemistry, but I think there's some synergy in terms of the models that are being built and the ability to build on top of those innovations that come from totally different fields. I think the domain-specific models that are being built now, and I want to go back to AlphaFold. I mean, it was 50 years. The PDB was founded in 1971. It was 50 years of PhD students and postdocs solving structures in labs over many years that created a very specific data set that we can now leverage for some of the problems that we're looking to solve in terms of protein structure and some of the things that are going on there. But I do think those foundational pieces around ML models coming from videos and images really kind of propelled this whole field forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it brings up an important point that, in my opinion, I feel like the biotechnology, biopharmaceutical industry can do a better job actually of being a part of the kind of the tech and AI zeitgeist. I think, you know, on the outside, biology seems like a very complex to outsiders. So any ideas how the biotech industry can get better at this and can do a better job of communicating with the rest of the world, and relatedly, how do we make it so biotech's faster at adopting technology from other fields?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually in the biopharma industry, biotech, as we described with the Nimbus Morphic story, are probably the faster adopters relative to biopharma.
Sure.
But we're seeing...
You had to literally create a new company from the ground up to do
correct.
It.
Correct. Yeah. But I think what we're seeing now is biopharma as a whole, large pharma, we have a lot of collaborations now with large pharma who are recognizing the moment we're in and are adopting it faster. But I think as an industry, we have a responsibility, and pretty awesome responsibility, in the sense that we have to be realistic about what's possible. Mm-hmm. I believe that what we do as an industry is extraordinarily complex. And any complexity we can reduce by having these methods and leveraging these methods and validating them and demonstrating the advancements that we're making versus in more empirical methods, that's absolutely key. But what we must also be very careful about is not overhyping it, because then we set ourselves up for disappointment, and the expectations are too high, and you can drive the whole space into this winter of discontent, if you like, where the results don't quite match the expectations. So I think it's a huge and profound responsibility that we have to balance validation and demonstration of impact with the excitement we have, all of us, that mm-hmm. computation is really here to stay and is going to make a huge difference.
Yeah. So Schrodinger takes a very different approach to drug discovery. You obviously have, you know, computational methods incorporated from the first step. Traditional teams in biopharma might have a, you know, 10-to-1 ratio of medicinal chemists to computational chemists, but your teams are structured differently.
Yes.
How are they structured, and what impact does this have on drug discovery?
Yeah, increasingly our teams are looking very different. Now we're in the clinic. Our chief medical officer is in these meetings, right, talking about how we're designing a drug and what we should be designing. But you're quite right that, you know, when I joined the industry, biologists were outnumbered by chemists by a very significant degree on project teams. Biologists obviously became more important on project teams at some point. But now our teams are really different. We have physicists, machine learning experts, importantly at Schrodinger, rather than having one computational chemist supporting maybe 5 or 6 programs, which is how it was when I was in the discovery group at Merck, now we have an equal number of computational chemists to medicinal chemists on our teams.
And that's still probably the highest ratio in the industry.
In terms of design, anyway. Of course, you've still got to synthesize the molecules. But also, you have this incredible multidisciplinary team, which I don't think will be a surprise to anyone here, of, you know, like I said, clinical people, translational people, all trying to tackle the problem in parallel instead of in series, which is how we used to do things.
You know, even before Schrodinger, you had a lot of different roles across the entire R&D process. You know, you've worked in clinical pharmacology, discovery, even business development. How has this shaped your vision for how an R&D organization should work? And what can we learn from you about breaking down silos between different teams?
Yeah, well, I'm fundamentally nosy. I was known at Merck for kind of going into other divisions and asking what their problems were. It sort of underlies this idea that there's a lot of, it's sort of the same as the last topic, there's a lot of interdependencies between different specialty areas in a pharmaceutical company. And I think we're breaking down those silos. The problem with the silos, in my opinion, was the handoffs. You know, the chemist would hand off to the biologist would hand off to the pharmacologist, right?
And a bunch of context got lost.
A lot of context gets lost. A lot of the challenge of drug discovery is figuring out what's going to kill the program as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And the more you integrate the people who have to make those serial series of decisions as one group, all talking together, and understanding what matters mm-hmm. Across those different disciplines, I think the better decisions that you end up making. So the idea for me was I wanted this very broad toolbox. I wanted to understand what gives in clinical development, in early development. What problems are our clinical people facing?
Do you think every, you know, discovery scientist should do a tour of duty in clinical pharmacology or business development even?
I encourage it. I actually think that it's really important for people to spend time in other domains. I describe it as the T, right? We all have our long arm of the T. That's our expertise that we trained in. But the top bar of the T, we have to explore it as broadly as possible so you understand what the rest of the value chain is going through.
Yeah. So doing a stint in business development helped you be a better head of R&D.
Absolutely. Obviously, most of what we do requires collaboration. Collaboration is nice when you're talking about what science experiment should we do, but actually the business side of that matters even more. Yeah.
All right. I think we're just at time, so I'm going to bring things home. Do you see a future where every biopharma and biotech company uses AI, ML, and computation to accelerate their R&D? And how quickly can we get there? And sorry, this is a four-part question to end. And since I only get one more question, and so for those companies, I'm sure you meet with many who are, you know, who come to Schrödinger, who want to maybe feel a little bit behind on their AI journey and want to accelerate. Like, what are the biggest hurdles that those organizations have to overcome, whether they're financial, cultural, resource driven, talent, or entirely something else? So maybe give some advice on that.
So to the first part, I would say the future is now. I don't think there is any biopharma company, whether that's a biotech or a pharma, large pharma company, that is not using AI, ML, computation in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. To different degrees, of course. But whether it's in regulatory, where they're using it to write regulatory documents, or at the very front end to come up with the hits.
Yep.
I think everybody's doing it already. It's the question of how much are they using it and how much are they connecting it across different groups? The second part of your question was?
The second part was, you know, you must interface with a lot of biopharma companies.
Yes.
Who come to Schrödinger who
What's the gap?
Want to kind of get to the future faster.
Yeah.
What are the hurdles they face and what advice do you have for them?
I mean, I think the hurdles are that, especially in larger companies, they're set up a certain way, right? The Merck campus was massive. There was a whole building full of chemists. How do you undo that? How do you retrain people to embrace a whole different workflow? That is a challenge. I think the other is that there is a shortage of people with specific kinds of training. And the one that I like the most is the idea that we now have physician scientists who also now know how to write ML code.
That's a lot,
right?
For a person. You've been in school for a long time.
I think some of the big schools have joint programs, yeah. Right? But the talent gap, I think, and that sort of multilingual type of talent, I think, is at a shortage right now. I'm pretty sure a lot of people in this room are sort of ready to fill that gap, but that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges. And then the other is the proof points, right? Does this actually work before I go too far and invest too much?
Yeah.
I think that is a real challenge, but I think we're making a huge amount of progress as an industry in that space.
All right, you heard it here first. This time is different. Thank you so much, Karen, for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.